Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to The Academic Life, a podcast channel here on New Books Network. I'm Dr. Christina Gessler, your host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Dante Stewart about his book, Shouting in the Fire, An American Epistle. Welcome to the show, Dante.
Hey, Dr. Gessler, so good to be with you.
I am so glad that you're here and that we get to talk about your book. I wonder if, to start us off, you will please tell us a bit about yourself.
Yes. So I am Dante Stewart. I am currently living in Augusta, Georgia. I'm a husband. I'm a father. I have two beautiful children. My wife and I, we've been married for 7 years now, and my wife is in the Air Force. So we're stationed here in Augusta, Georgia. We're both from South Carolina, so I'm born and raised in the rural part of South Carolina, where I like to tell people that the best food, you know, for us, is at the gas station. As you know, as you read my book, you know, that the gas stations and food show up a lot, whatnot in food in my book. And so I'm from that rural part. We both went to Clemson. I'm a minister. At Tabernacle Baptist Church, as well as many people know now, a writer and a student currently at Emory University, the Candler School of Theology at Emory University, doing my theological studies, particularly on James Baldwin, and doing a close theological and literary reading of Baldwin and kind of seeing what can be gleaned from Baldwin. So, yeah, that's a little bit about me.
Thank you for sharing that. Our listeners are pretty interested in higher ed. So can you tell us how you chose your college?
Yeah, actually, you know, this story is quite interesting. So I was originally at two schools before I end up being at Emory University. And for those who read the book, they will know that, you know, I was very deeply immersed in Southern Baptist tradition of religion and doing faith life and things like that. And so usually, you know, and this holds true for outside of religious spaces as well, just in general, that usually the people who you're around most, who you're closely connected to, who is in your social networks, are usually those whom, you know, you go to school where they go to school, you know. So if you're living in South Carolina, you know, the two big schools are Clemson University and South Carolina, University of South Carolina. So, you know, you start talking about going to school and especially if you start playing, if you play sports like I did, you know, for a lot of us growing up there, you know, those are the two main options. Even if we don't really think about, sadly, we don't think about going to HBCUs, which we should, or whatnot. So being inside of those Southern Baptist spaces, you know, I was originally at two conservative seminaries. First, I was at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, and then I transferred to Reformed Theological Seminary. And then, you know, I kind of went through a transformation in my own thinking and in my own life around 2016-2017. And, you know, it kind of untethered me from so many ways of thinking and being in the world. And I started really thinking about education and if I'm going to be spending money, what type of degree do I need to be getting, as well as what type of person is that institution trying to form me into, you know, once I walk across the stage, you know, with a degree from their institution. And I'm also thinking about, you know, as it relates to curriculum and what type of curriculum would I be immersed in? What type of networks would that school immerse me in regarding ideas of race, gender, sexuality, and demographics, and denominational, and even religious traditions? So I wanted somewhere, you know, that I can go and be myself as a person, but also that I can broaden my understanding of myself and my own kind of embodied experience. And so I knew I needed better curriculum. I knew I needed better faith traditions. I knew I needed better conversation partners and colleagues. And so then, you know, through many kind of conversations and things like that, I decided that Emory University was the school for me. And now, you know, a year and a half later, it has proven true to be an institution that really I think does a really good job at forming us and informing us and challenging us in many ways, but also as an institution that I think has a lot of room to grow or whatnot. And so I think, you know, for the time, for the duration that I'm here, and I want to join many of the other students who either came before me or who are currently here, who are trying to help Emory, particularly Candler School of Theology, become the best type of institution that it can be. And so, yeah, that's kind of, you know, why I chose this school, because of the rigor, you know, the academic rigor, but also the kind of intellectual imagination and creative engagement that I felt like I was going to get here.
That's wonderful that you've had such a path through so many places that really helped you be very intentional about where you are now. Mm-hmm. When you first started higher ed, though, you were at Clemson, you were an undergrad, mm-hmm. and you write about that quite a bit in the book. Clemson is a very white school.
Oh, yes.
It was a culture shock. And it was a time where you were really remaking your identity and something that you would spend a lot of years then really looking at and reckoning with all that time that you spent at Clemson. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah. Great question. So like, I love the way you kind of characterize my story is this idea of making myself and remaking myself. And I think, you know, that gets at the heart of the kind of narrative that sits at the center of my book, is that wrestling with that question of what does it mean to be Black and Christian and American, and how to navigate the ways in which those identities intersect in some of the most beautiful and terrible ways possible. And so, like you said, it really was a moment of learning and relearning. And really that process begins really back at home in my Pentecostal upbringing and in some sense in rural South Carolina, where so many of us who grow up where I grew up at in St. Matthews, between St. Matthews, Swansea and Sandaron, when you start talking about quote unquote making it, oftentimes the kind of message underneath, you know, or less laced within that idea of quote unquote making it is, you know, proximity to white spaces. And so many of us, when I was pretty decent at football or whatnot, and so many of us started talking about being recruited, it was like, you know, the top schools in many ways are predominantly white institutions, i.e. Clemson and the University of South Carolina. And it, in some sense, it upholds this unspoken reality that white is right and better, and that whiteness and white social life and social space, as I would deem many of these institutions, that white social space will get me where I believe I need to go. But as I write about in the book, that we have to always be asking the question, when I enter into certain spaces, what is the cost and what is the price to pay? And so as I talk about in the chapter Wages, you know, there's always a cost to my presence. And oftentimes in these institutions, you know, as young Black people and other demographics, we are those whom the cost is incurred the most. We are the ones who have to pay the largest price, whether that be through our silence or whether that be through our assimilation or whether that be through our performance. It's almost an expectation of the institution that we would, you know, as I write about, jump high, run fast, or whatnot, and just be about our schoolwork and not make too much commotion about, you know, the kind of space that we're living in. And so at Clemson, it was not all a bad experience. I met my wife there. I spent some time playing football. You know, I had a great time playing ball. I met great friends. I felt like I got a really, really good degree, and I really keep in touch with so many of the academic staff that's there still to this day, who either have transitioned or still there, you know. But at the end of the day, as I write about, you know, the script, there's a hidden script, and I would even say that there's a hidden logic, you know, underneath all of us coming there and being there and kind of, you know, being in that space. And the hidden logic is, in some sense, you know, the upholding of white domination and white power structures, whether that be through curriculum, whether that be through decision making, whether that be through, you know, something as simple as last year when Clemson football put Black Lives Matter stickers on the helmet and the fan base went absolutely crazy simply because the football team made a decision, the players made a decision that they wanted to stand in solidarity with Black lives. But for many of the fan base and many of the people who invested in that type of institutional space, the cost is too great for them to believe that Black people are not just simply human, but worthy of the deepest love and worthy of the same type of protection that they want for their children. And so when many of us come from rural spaces, when we go into these white social space, oftentimes, you know, we kind of get along, you know, so we don't make too much commotion and we kind of get our degree and we kind of, you know, move into the world and never really asking, you know, who is benefiting in this environment? Who is benefiting by me being there? And I think this is one of the critical things that I learned at Clemson, whether that be was through the kind of white religious spaces I was moving through or playing football, is that, you know, the university and the context there really could survive without ever taking seriously our Black humanity. And I think that's something critical for people to think about, is that what spaces can survive without taking into account another person's humanity? And oftentimes that will reveal a space that was not built for us. And I would say, as many of us students walk and see the name of slaveholders still on university buildings, and when you talk about who's making the decisions for our lives and curriculum and what type of world we are being invited to and what type of world is being shaped for us, many of those people don't look like us. And I think we need to take that into account. And so, yeah, being at Clemson, it was beautiful, but I do think that it shaped me in ways, you know, that I took for granted, especially in the ways that I learned to divinize white social space and whiteness and learn to demonize our Black lives and the kind of worlds we were building. And so, yeah, that's probably the way I would kind of begin to think about that question.
There's so much about your experience at Clemson that really informs the book and the trajectory that you go on from there to where you are now. There are so many things that you wrote about that stood out to me. One was your description about being a football player and about how white fans treated you and your realization that you could sacrifice your entire body for them and that would be fine. Another was the way you talked about the fans' enthusiasm and being on the team and the games. To me, it felt like a religious experience, the frenzy that people got into, the energy, the sense of rightness. Can you talk about what football was for you at Clemson? And if I read that correctly, that you were overlaying some of that sense of almost a religion of football.
So, yeah, I was actually at homecoming last week and it was kind of crazy, especially thinking about football as religion. And I thought about the aesthetic of being there and what message, what stories are being told in this type of environment. And I think that's really what I'm trying to get at. And I read a really good book not too long ago by Richard Hughes called Myths. It's about myths and the story that gives American meanings. And Richard Hughes was talking about white supremacy and the ways in which like myth is not just simply a fictitious story, but it is a story that people make sense of the world and present the world in coherent form, and it helps them name, see, and act within the world. And as I was sitting there at the football game and the kickoff was about to get started and our team has already come down the hill, the cannons done blew and the fireworks are going off, and I'm sitting, you know, in a sea of white fans, and I'm looking around and I'm like, you know, there's spurts of like black people around me, and I'm, you know, it's more than just simply a little bit, but given the number of fans there, you know, it feels like a spurts in my section. And I'm looking, and now it comes on the telecom, you know, we're gonna stand for the anthem, then we're gonna hey, put your hand over your heart, and we're gonna say the Pledge of Allegiance, then we're gonna have an invocation. So they have a prayer before the football game and things, and then, you know, it has a section about, you know, a hero of the month or things like that. And when and it has time where so much of this idea of patriotism and religion is wrapped up within football. And for many people, many would think that something like that is just simply harmless. But I think we have to wrestle with the question of what story is this telling me, especially when you talk about, you know, this idea of patriotism and whose life matter, and when it comes to like who should guide this program. You know, I think about this on the heels of many of the things that have been happening, you know, politically, you know, and talking about the flag and talking about and talking about the anthem, and wrestling with the question, you know, that many have a problem with, like, young athletes, you know, I mean, many don't have a problem with young athletes using their platform for Military Appreciation Game or Breast Cancer Awareness Month, or whatnot. But it's not necessarily, you know, the platforms, you know, that is the problem, but it's the way in which, you know, people want to control, you know, the ways in which we stand in solidarity with our black humanity. And this, and in some sense, this idea of who matters and who don't, like, what, who, like who gets to guide the institution and the program and who don't, is wrapped up in some sense in this idea of religion. I think when we're talking about religion, I'm thinking about the kind of ground in what we think in morality and rightness and what should be in a certain type of givenness. And, you know, I think many have taken for granted that many, when we talk about black athletes in general, many of us have given, you know, we talk about the ultimate sacrifice, and talking about death and life, the ultimate sacrifice is not just simply giving your life and death, but oftentimes, many times, the ultimate sacrifice is also giving people what they don't deserve of your life, you know, if that makes sense. And so it's not just, ultimate sacrifice is not just relegated to someone dying for another. But ultimate sacrifice is oftentimes us giving people what they don't deserve. And it's the best years of our life to build their power, to build their wealth, to build their institutions, just so they can turn around and tell us that the full expression of our humanity does not have room to grow here, but it can only be accepted and loved and cherished when we perform and score a touchdown and give them memories that they can talk about around the dinner table. And so I wrote this essay last year that I actually, interestingly enough, I did not, that we were talking earlier about, you know, what was like included in the book and what was not included in the book. I wrote this essay last year and it just did not fit in the book. I just felt like, you know, with the way I narrated my time at Clemson, I felt like I did as best job as I could, you know, with that narrative. But I wrote an essay last year called Dear White Clemson Fan. And it was in response to the ways in which many of the white fans were responding, as I said earlier, to athletes standing in solidarity with Black lives, particularly in response to the protests in honor and memory of many who were lost, particularly Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, and George Floyd. And so I wrote this essay that trying to argue that, you know, that our bodies, you know, forcing white people to see our bodies on the field, forcing white people to see the ways in which our bodies have been forgotten, marginalized, and abused on and off the field is not just simply for their like enjoyment and their consumption, But there's that says something like our humanity, our being alive, the way Kevin Kwashi writes in his book, Black Aliveness. Our being alive is the very fundamental expression of our humanity, and that needs to be taken seriously. But it doesn't just stop there. Like, we Black people, we are donors. We are alumni. We are taxpayers who, too, have made both America and Clemson what white people imagine as, quote unquote, great. So that means that this institution, this reality, this system also belongs to us who are fighting for our lives and for our children and the students who look like us. Because it's not just simply that this is the world in which that this religion of whiteness that J. Kemba Carter speaks of is not just simply confined to the football field and the ways in which, you know, these fans worship athletes, but also that worship is also wrapped up in their devotion to their own ideas of their own centeredness and supremacy. So it's like white fans really believe, like truly, like legit, like this ain't even no game. Like they truly believe that, like, they own us. Like it's like that is not an embellishment. That when you believe that athletes can't stand in solidarity with people who look like them and they can't exercise their First Amendment right to talk about race, to talk about religion, to talk about politics in ways that's alternative or in resistance to dominant forms of thinking about race, religion, and politics, then you truly believe that you own that person. Because as Alex Walker says, you know, no person is your friend who demands your silence. And so they're not friends in a sense, but it's a certain type of transaction. And I think when we talk about religion and football and things like that, it's not just confined to the ways in which, you know, white religion is so in closest proximity to us Black athletes, which I write about the ways in which, like, I got hooked up with Fellowship of Christian Athletes and how that formed me as a person and distanced me from my hometown and changed the way I talk and changed the way I thought. But also we need to talk about this religion as the ways in which, like, you know, people believe it's their God-given right to own us and to shape, you know, to shape our lives and to tell us the boundaries to which we can live and move and have our being in. And so I remember James Baldwin saying that it is certain that in any case, that ignorance allied with power is the most ferocious enemy justice can have. And if we think about justice, not just simply as, you know, as wrongs being made right, but also as the embrace of the fullness of our humanity, our dignity, our creativity, and our capacity to live and create worlds and be in the world, then we have to say that oftentimes, you know, on the football field, you know, and in the institution, you know, we are oftentimes, you know, treated in ways that are ignorant and in ways that are allied with power, that oftentimes, you know, treat us as less than human, as second class, and exploit our labor and our creativity and our bodies and continually force us into a system of disrespect. And I think, you know, I think many of that needs to change. And hopefully, you know, hopefully over the years, as we exist, as Dave Zirin writes about incredibly in his book, The Kaepernick Effect, how he tells the story of so many students, younger people, resonating so much with what Colin Kaepernick did and the ultimate price he paid of his livelihood and things like that. The way Dave Zirin write about in this moment of the Kaepernick effect, hopefully we can see a better system and a more equitable system and a system that really takes into account, you know, the fullness of our humanity, not just simply on the field, but when we're off the field, when we're in the classroom, where we're just trying to be normal and human and not just simply cherishing Black athletes, but loving Black people because we're human and should be protected.
You mentioned Kaepernick and how his taking a stand ended his professional career as he knew it. When you were a student and you were playing, you were a walk-on. Mm-hmm. And at that time, it was 2012, and mm-hmm. Trayvon Martin was killed. He was 17 years old.
Yes.
And it was a huge emotional event. And there were team players who wanted to protest, who wanted to take a picture of a group wearing hoodies in solidarity. And you couldn't. You felt that you couldn't protest. You felt that you could not be in the picture. You were not secure on the team. You were a walk-on. You saw yourself as someone who had to be very dependable, not just to the team, but in your studies, that you were representing your family back home. There was so many competing pressures on you.
Yes, yes.
Do you feel in some ways it's the former players who need to take a stand because the current players are too precarious, even if they have a contract?
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Great question. I do think if I'm hearing you correctly, I do think that we former players do have a responsibility to stand up for former athlete for current athletes in ways, you know, that I don't think that they can stand for themselves. And I think that was one of the reasons why I really wanted to write this section the way I did, is because I knew that as many of my young dudes who are still playing college football, whether they're at Clemson, Western Carolina, or other places, you know, many of them, you know, will need in some sense, or I would want them to read something like this so that they can be informed about like, this is how you move and maneuver while you're in this space. Like, you have to realize that, you know, yes, your name is on the back of your jersey or whatnot, but your name is not on the check, you know, when it comes to who making the decisions. And so I think we have to talk about power dynamics, especially as it relates to college football athletics. And so that's really one of the reasons why I wrote that narrative the way I did, because I wanted some other athlete to be free who may be wrestling with that question, you know, and that reality that I wrestle with, where, you know, for me, being good at football was more important than being Black. And I don't think that that's just something that I, as an individual, you know, struggle with. But I often think that this oftentimes a story that's wrought within, you know, many of the spaces like Clemson University and many of our many of the other kind of Division I predominantly white institutions, is that being good at football is more important than being Black, and then more important than Trayvon, as I write, Trayvon's Black body being murdered in the streets and our Black bodies taking a photo was my Black body's distance from both. And I think this represents the kind of dynamic that many of young athletes are wrestling with, is many of us feel like there is too much at stake for us to be honest either about our own limitations when it comes to dynamics of race and Black life, but also the kind of punishment that could be ours if we veer too far from the script that we have inherited inside of this space of college football. And so that's probably one of the reasons why I wrote it, is like, I wanted other young athletes to be free, and I wanted them to know, like, yo, these are things you need to be thinking about. This can give you a way to think about this critically, that, you know, you have to realize, like, yo, more important than me just simply, you know, giving them the best of my life, is me finding out and finding myself and what it means to live and love people who look like me, while also trying to live and love people who are different than me. And I don't think that there's much room in the space that I walked in for that to be a reality, because so much is at stake. And I don't think, you know, when so much is at stake, especially as it relates to what you will lose when loss is like the center of your story, then, you know, protests or resistance will not be the method of your being in this space. When loss is like at the center of your story, then resistance and protest would not be your method of action, because there's too great a cost to pay. And so I do think for many athletes, which I kind of, you know, see right now, and even going through 2020, there were so many young dudes who were talking to me, both my teammates and guys who are still playing ball to this day, in the league, or who are playing ball now in college. We were just talking about so much, because they were trying to figure out, you know, how how do I work in this dynamic? And I don't have the answer to that, but I at least wanted to wrestle with that question of the ways in which I saw myself failed in the past and the ways in which I wanted to see us get better in the present.
There's a sense in that chapter that you're, as you're writing it in hindsight, you're also at the same time inhabiting the mindset you had at the time. And so we see you as the man looking at the teenage boy, because you must have been, what, 18, 19?
Yeah.
When Trayvon was killed, yes. He was a teenager. You were a teenager. The guys on the team who were trying to decide what kind of protests to do, they're teenagers. This is a huge amount to put onto teenagers to try to figure out how to change the system from within.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And that's on top of trying to perform. That's on top of trying to perform well, like on the football field, because we're there to play. We're there to do as best we can, like on the field. And the reality is that, like, sadly, we can't just simply think about being good on the field, but we have to think about being good in real life off the field so that we survive, you know, and that we make sure that, like, our parents don't get labeled as bad Black parents, or that, you know, people who look like us won't get labeled as being bad people, you know. So there's so much pressure on us that oftentimes we're not given ways to think about that does not just simply ignore them and distance us from them. And so you're talking about trying to play well. You're talking about trying to get your schoolwork. You're also talking about trying to build networks outside of the football field, which I feel like we're terrible at, that oftentimes there's Clemson, you know, and there's Black Clemson, and then there's Black student athlete Clemson, who is given more privilege, more love, more protection than Black Clemson. And so you have these inequities of power, even within our own kind of racial narratives, where we Black student athletes are prioritized more, even when we're in a given system of difference that prioritize our humanity less, you know. And so that's an incredible weight to carry, that I think we should carry in some sense, because those who came before us, and I'm thinking in particular Paul Robeson, the book The Heritage, Howard Bryant writes about brilliantly about Paul Robeson, as well as William C. Roden in his book $40 Million Slave, where they talk about these traditions of Black athletes not just simply allowing their humanity to be left in the locker room and be disregarded once they step on the field. But wherever these Black athletes went, they took their whole selves. And not all of them did that, but many of them did that. And that's the complexity of the story, is that I represent the person who felt that the cost was too great. I represent the person who failed, in a sense, you know, but also in that failure, I can also understand myself. And that's the complexity of the type of story that I was trying to write, is that, you know, I don't want to write this triumphal narrative. And it's not a triumphal narrative. It just is what it is. And hopefully, you know, as I tried to think about, hopefully you can better understand yourself. I can better understand myself, and we could try and find out better ways to respond if and when those moments happen again. Because it's like after Trayvon, you thinking like, oh man, Trayvon moment is just so terrible. But that happened years ago, and now we're here in 2021, and the same thing is still happening to many of our Black lives, whether that be young Black men, young Black women, Black gay and trans folk, many Black poor people. We're still living in a country that believes that our lives are valued less, as Eddie Glaude write about in his book, Democracy in Black. There still exists the value gap in our society. And that value gap shows up in a myriad of ways that I do think that many of us who are former athletes have a responsibility to think about and talk about. And that's really, I felt like, you know, when I wrote that essay, Dear White Clemson Fan, I encourage people to check it out. Shameless plug. I encourage people to check it out.
It's an important plug. Huh? It's an important yeah, plus.
Yeah. I felt like, you know, that it was my way of kind of like just telling white people, I won't curse right now, but telling white people, forget you, but use your imagination for the other word I was going to use. It was my kind of creative way of telling white people, forget you, and the terrible ways you think about black life. But it was also my creative way of telling like young black folk, like, yo, hey, here it is. This the game right here. And you're going to need some type of language and some type of framework to think about what's happening. And I wanted to write something that would you feel loved and seen, but also you giving some language and some type of thing, you know, when to like when you go in this world, you don't just need to have, you know, an experience talking about your experience of being young and black in this world. But you need some type of critical frameworks to analyze this system so that, you know, we can deconstruct it and build something better in this place. So, yeah.
The book is constructed as a series of essays, and each essay has a single word title. One is terror, one is the fire. And every essay is really about a key theme, and yet the themes run throughout all of the essays. So like you said, it's not a hero's journey where we feel relieved at the end. It's a highly complex story of how all of these themes are interwoven and we go back and forth in time. And as you said, we don't just hear about Trayvon's killing. We don't even really have time to process that when there's another and another and another. And in the midst of you telling us about that, and you're at Clemson and you have the athlete status when you're on campus. If you go off campus, none of that holds. So you're driving your car and you get stopped. You have no idea why. Your mom has already taught you what to do when you get stopped. And you take us through all of these police cars showing up and this hope you have that if they can see your Clemson jacket in the car, that this will somehow give you an extra piece of protection off campus, like it does on. Can you take us through that experience you had as a college student?
Oh yeah, I'll never forget that night. I will never forget that night. And without kind of, you know, going too much into the intricacies of detail, just because the story is so detailed in a sense, and in the ways that I write about it. But like, you know, I'll never forget what it was like to be in Greenville that night and getting lost, and that being. Like you would think that, you know, getting lost, you know, that somebody would immediately come to your help and think about, you know, hey, like a cop, that if a cop sees a car and you have the awareness that you're lost, but the cop doesn't have that awareness that you're lost. But the immediate assumption of this police officer is that this person is in the wrong type of car, in the wrong type of place, at the wrong type of time. And that this is, in some sense, a story that is written within the very history of our country, is that oftentimes police officers that we have been objectified, we have been demonized, and we have been killed, and we have been terrorized simply because people have been given power with a badge in a ways, you know, how I like, and I'm glad that you noted that and was very perceptive about these running themes and metaphor within my work. I try to be very, you know, creative as a writer in the craft and in the structure and the narrative and the plot to weave these metaphors within my story, to have a kind of, you know, have a working metaphor underneath each chapter, or whatnot, to have a working metaphor underneath each chapter. And I think one of those metaphors is like these, and this is what we call them, these white boys with badges. You know, there's something about white boys with badges, you know, because they're treating us in ways that are immature and that are ignorant, you know, and these white boys with badges, you know, are treating us as if we don't matter. And so that night is a very, you know, that night was very fearful, you know, and I didn't even have to, you know, there's this story, you know, that our parents tell us that, you know, you got to be careful, you got to watch this. And then we get this from when we're very young, and many people call it the talk. Or whatnot, but I don't want to make much of, you know, too much of that in a sense, because, you know, many people think as if like every Black parent at every moment in their lives are just simply thinking about white racism and white terrorism and giving us the talk as if like every exhausting moment we are thinking about white people. And that's just not the case in Black life. And I would think about Imani Perry's incredible essay with The Atlantic, racism is terrible. Blackness is not. And so, you know, that night, though, that was terrible. And that was a terrible moment where me and my mom is existing in this space of fear where, you know, the only thing that really, you know, the only thing that you can really do in that moment is pray that that officer, you know, really is in a good mood that night, you know, that that officer will see the things that I have on and see, you know, that I'm a young kid and would treat me like a human. And sadly, I'll never forget. I think Kathy Park Hong had a great little line on this, you know, in her book Minor Feelings, where she talked about like, you know, white children, you know, white men can be thought of as children, like white grown men can be thought of as children, you know, but young Black people, young Asian people, young Hispanic people, young Native American and indigenous folk are thought of as adults too early. And I was hoping that somehow in that moment that that officer would view me as the child that I was, as I write about athletes. When we're on these campuses, that's who we truly are. We're children. But for me, that day was not just another day. It meant, as I write about, being in the presence of white people who thought I was suspicious and could think that way for no other reason than their belief in their right to police what they didn't believe was normal. And so that officer didn't think that, you know, me just simply trying to find my way was normal. The officer didn't think that me being in my car, my Black Honda, was normal. And the officer didn't think that me being in that geographical location in that city was normal. And that night, you know, it taught me a lesson that, you know, in this world, that none of that, in this world that we live in, this country that we live in, it don't matter how, you know, how great my grades is, it don't matter how well I play, it don't matter how good I am, more I am, you know, none of that will protect us against people or from people who view us with suspicion more than they view us as sacred. And so that night really, you know, taught me a lot of things and really taught me, you know, that this country judges us differently. And I need to be very mindful of that. And in some sense, be careful of that, but not in some sense, you know, make the totality of my being about that. And I think that this is one of the, I think this is one of the limitations of so much of the conversation about Black life, is that many people think that Black life is just simply about what white people do to us. And it's just not the case. But as Terrion Williamson writes, the Black feminist theorist, that there is a space in our lives, you know, in which we create worlds, Black world making, we make the world. And it's not just simply about what white people do to us, but it's about the way we live and move and have our being and perform a world and create things and perform, you know, in ways that cherish our humanity and just embrace our ordinariness in ways that, you know, is not concerned just simply about resistance or fighting or struggling, but simply being alive, being free, and being in love.
And you bring us those stories woven throughout all the essays. You introduce us to your mom, to your girlfriend who becomes your wife. Towards the end of the book, we get to meet your grandmother. Can you tell us about some, pick any of the family stories that you want to share? I love all of them. So whichever you want to start with.
I love talking about my grandmother. I really do love talking about my grandmother, and just like me and my grandmother, we just have such a great relationship. When I think about, you know, being a young kid and like going to grandma's house, you know, for many of us, you know, grandma's house represented so much of the fun things of life that we couldn't wait for. Like, we couldn't wait for to go into grandma's house and things like that, and like playing with our cousins and getting together. Cause a lot of times when we gathered at grandma's house, it was like, you know, it was gonna be food involved, it was gonna be playing involved, it was gonna be like just like running in the woods with sticks, playing swords and things like that, like play fighting and things like that. But also like in my grandma's house, like there was so much history around, you know, whether it was in story form or on, you know, whether it was in story form or whether it was, through pictures, there was just so much history. And my grandmother is an absolutely beautiful person and an absolutely beautiful storyteller. So like when I talk to my grandma, even to this day, I can call my grandma right now, you know, and my grandma has this little high pitched way of laughing. So she'll be like, she'll tell a story from back in the day, and she'll be like, you know, they said this and that. And then she'll just be laughing. I can't understand hardly anything she's saying, but like that story is bringing her so much joy. You know, my grandmother is in her upper 80s, and you know that, you know, if we simply do the math, you know, being just simply being born, it's 2021. You know, we're living in 2021, and if you think about 80 years ago, just simply 80 years ago, that's 1941. Now, if we think about 2021 and 87 years ago, that's 1934. That's on the back end of the Depression. That's in the crux for many of the Black folk growing up in her time, or my grandfather, you know, they're growing up in the Depression. They're growing up between the wars. They're growing up, you know, in the heart of Jim Crow South. They're growing up. I did that 20 years later in 1954 would be Brown versus Board of Education. 21 years later, in 1964 would be the Civil Rights Act. 31 years later would be the Voting Rights Act. And so my grandma is someone who came of age in the Jim Crow South, who has a particular, very visceral way of understanding what it means to live and have to raise children in a world, have to love and find love and be human and not let this world destroy you. To do those type of things and build a world that is beautiful, that's not engulfed by the toxicity of white supremacy. And so I love talking about my grandmother, I'll never forget, you know, going back home not too long ago, and sitting on the porch with her and talking to her about the house and talking about my granddaddy, who has dementia right now. And he comes to the door and he's knocking on the door to get out. He can't let out because you got to lock everything, you know, and whatnot. And for those who read, they would know my granddaddy got lost. And just, you know, my grandmother having to go through that, not just go through, you know, this history, which is very visceral. This is her reality and many of our realities. This is a reality written on the cracks of her hand and the lines of her hands and her veins that show on her hands and the beating of her chest and the grays in her head. This is a history that's written on her body. And I just sometimes just want to sit down with her like I do and did not too long ago. Just sit down and say, like, grandma, you know, tell me about it. And sometimes she want to tell me, sometimes she don't. And sometimes I got to trick her into telling me and things like that, because I truly believe that, like, their stories don't just simply matter, but I do think that their stories are critical, you know, to our understanding of our own selves. And I truly believe that as they pass on into far greater lands and they go from being elders to ancestors, that I believe their stories still speak. And I want to be the type of person, you know, that captured my grandmother's story in ways that were beautiful and honest and true and not hopeful, because in hope, hope is an interesting term or whatnot that I kind of in some sense wanted to deconstruct in the type of way that I wrote about, you know, my family, whether about my brother or about my mother, or about my grandmother, about my granddaddy, or about this country, or about our faith. You know, I wanted to deconstruct those narratives and write something more honest, more true, more loving. And I do think that, you know, my grandmother, she has so many of those stories, and she represents so much of the type of storytelling that I want to be like. And I felt like it was necessary to write a really Black book. And I couldn't write that really Black book without writing about a Southern Black woman who grew up in the Jim Crow South, who's still alive today. And her grandson is a writer. In this moment, I just felt like I had a responsibility to tell her story in some type of way that, you know, you don't know what life holds, but I at least know that in this book, my grandmother can hold this book and know that, you know, because at the end of the day, you know, she's lived most of her days, and we pray for many, many years. But, you know, she's blessed to live so long. But we know that, you know, human beings, you know, we have limitations, but I at least know that, you know, that my first book will always have her life and her story just drenched on the pages.
You talk about in the book that you keep a journal, and we know that you're writing this while you're at seminary school, in grad school. When did you start keeping a journal, and when did you decide to write this book?
Yes, I started keeping a journal in 2014, actually. So like when I went through so many when me and Jazz went through so many transitions in California, we were stationed in there, as I write about in the book. You know, I started reading a little bit, but then I started journaling is just like, you know, it's like this kind of like spiritual practice that so many traditions lean on. And so where we were at, you know, I had some friends during that moment. They was like, yo, you should start journaling and writing things down and stuff like that. So I started doing that. And I still, like, I'm looking behind me in my office, and I still got my journals from 2014. I got maybe from 2014 to now, maybe like 10, 11 journals. That's just simply my life in written form, you know, and it goes through my ups and downs. And it really was a wave of me trying to make sense of myself and really kind of like, you know, write whatever I felt and try and bring some type of coherence in my story. And as I go back in my journal, I was telling my wife this the other day, you know, when I went back in my journal, especially for this book, I really had to become a historian of my own self. You know, so much of going back in time and writing memoir, especially being so young, I'm only 29 years old. And, you know, writing a memoir at 29 is like, it takes some audacity. Now that I look back on it, like to write a memoir at 29 years old, it takes some type of audacity to do that. Just because, like, you still got so much life ahead of you, you know. But I also think that, you know, I've lived a lot of life as well, even in 29 years. And I learned a lot. And I felt like that I had to, you know, do some archival things on my own self, and having my journals, you know, allowed me a window and an archive into my own self, where I was telling my wife, like, yo, like that dude back there, that dude was terrible. Like I made some terrible decisions. I made some terrible mistakes, but then there were also moments where I was like, you know, I'm so proud of myself for doing this, for saying this, you know, and things like that. And so when did I know that I wanted to write this book? I guess in some sense, you know, this book, you know, chose me instead of me choosing it. Like that, I felt like, you know, I had released like a self-published book in 2019. And then people just started recognizing that I actually did have a writing gift, you know, and it was just, you know, the reason I published that was like, I was like, you know, there's devotional and inspirational material out here, but I don't know if it's like any devotional and inspirational material that really centers Black literature and Black lives. And so I wanted to write something like that. And so I did. And it was just kind of me trying it out. And then it actually ended up being much better than I actually thought it was. And so many people really started affirming my gift as a writer. And I like to tell people that, like, this book and many of my writing, you know, now is not kind of, you know, somebody said something bad about me, so I'm trying to prove them wrong, or like, you know, white people did something to me and I'm trying to prove them wrong, or somebody back home hurt me, so I'm trying to prove them wrong, you know. But it was, writing this book is really, you know, I had so many people tell me that I could and that I was special and I had something to say, and I actually believed them. Because when I'll never forget this conversation that James Baldwin and Maya Angelou had about, you know, about rage, and like, if you're always angry, you can't produce anything, you can't create. And I took that seriously as I was writing my book. There are some angry parts in my book. There are some parts that's full of rage, where I had to take breaks in. But I wanted most of my book to be a type of book, to be the type of artwork that was, you know, full of trying to explore what does it mean to be, as June Jordan say, black alive and looking back at you. And so in some sense, this book was an expression of that kind of sermonic and poetic gesture in epistolatory form, that, like, to give a nod to like James Baldwin, that so much of James Baldwin's work was like in letter form, was in epistle form, was in memoir form, was in essay form. And so I wanted to, you know, as Baldwin did, write something that was like an epistle of love to black people, but also challenge notions of what an American love letter or an American epistle written by a black person would look like in the tradition of, you know, many black writers like K.S.A. Lehman, who wrote an American memoir, Heavy, an American memoir, or Jasmine Ward, who wrote Memory Reap, or Darnell Moore, wrote No Ashes in the Fire, or Ta-Nehisi Coates, who wrote Between the World and Me. Just the tradition of this nonfiction writing that really challenges and centers black life as it is lived, not just simply as it is stereotyped and caricatured.
And that really comes through. We've only been able to touch on really just a couple of the chapters of this book because it's so rich, and the chapters do make you want to go back to an earlier one and read things as you go through the book. You get more and more layers, so you want to go back and look at the earlier layer. So it's a wonderful book to read deeply and to look at the authors that you reference and that you quote. It's a beautiful weaving together of so many kinds of literature. In the few minutes we have left, I'd like to ask you, what do you hope this episode sparks for listeners?
Yeah, I think one of my biggest hopes is that, like you said, like listeners would really take seriously, like, our black stories are not just simply for white education. Like, our black stories are not just simply for us black folk to just simply throw away. But our black stories are worth preserving. They're worth loving. They're worth embracing. And I'll never forget this Audre Lorde quote. It is one of my absolute favorite Audre Lorde quotes. And I think it's a brilliant, beautiful quote that characterized so much of what I try to accomplish in my own work, and so much of the ways that I try to kind of communicate. She writes, "The white fathers told us, 'I think, therefore I am.' The black mother within each of us, the poet, whispers in our dreams, 'I feel, therefore I can be free.'" And without getting too much into a close reading of this one line, there's something to be said about writing in such a way that whispers in the dreams of people, that makes imagination come alive, that takes seriously, as Audre Lorde White writes, deconstructing the ways that these quote unquote white fathers who set themselves above us, who created a world of white supremacy that we inherit and have to live in and have to breathe and survive in, who tell us that, you know, that this kind of quote unquote, this objective, well put together life is real life. This being near to us and thinking in ways we think is real life and what you need. But no, the black mother within each of us, the poet, that person whispers in our dreams and tell us that we can be free. And so that's what I want to accomplish in this book, is a certain type of freedom that I know can be found and had in our, in telling the stories of our lives and embracing those stories and taking them seriously and loving who we are. And I think, you know, that we don't have to be perfect. Now I want readers to realize that, yo, Black people don't have to be perfect or dead or in performance or in pain to be loved, but that we are human and we are worthy of the deepest love possible. And we are worthy of learning and living in what June Jordan says, we are Black alive and looking back at you.
Thank you so much for being on the show today, Dante Stewart, and telling us about your new book, Shouting in the Fire, An American Epistle. You've been listening to The Academic Life on New Books Network. I hope you will please join us again.